Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Academy here at Christ Reformed Church. We're glad that you could come and spend the evening with us. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the worldview of naturalism, but when I complete my talk, we're going to give you an opportunity to ask some questions and to dialogue a little bit about this important topic. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a guest speaker who will be coming in. One thing we do with the Academy is we invite some distinguished Christian authors, and they come in and autograph their books, and so you're certainly welcome to come on those opportunities. And there's material at the back table. Before we begin, why don't we have a brief time of prayer, if you'll pray with me. Heavenly Father, we praise you and we worship you along with your Son and the Holy Spirit. Father, help us to think carefully about our beliefs. Help us to communicate the gospel and our Christian worldview with deep clarity and persuasion. And we rely upon your Spirit to help us do that. And we pray in the name of Christ the Lord. Amen. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to the worldview of naturalism. Naturalism is a dominant worldview in the Western world. It dominates the academic institutions, both in the United States and in Europe. Naturalism is a worldview that I do not see going away, even if some of its ideas have been questioned, such as Darwinism and things of that nature. It still permeates our world and is a formidable worldview that has been around since the time of the Enlightenment in the 1700s. Well, let's define naturalism. I like to say that naturalism is the view that nature is the whole show. Nature is the whole show. Naturalism, as traditionally defined, is the worldview system that regards the natural, material, and physical universe as the only reality. The world of nature is viewed as the sum total of reality, the whole show, all that actually exists. So nature is everything. That's all that exists. There's nothing outside of it. There's nothing to impact it from the outside. It's a closed system, as we like to say in philosophy. Naturalists typically view the universe as a closed and uniform system of material causes and effects with nothing existing outside the realm of nature. All reality is located within the exclusive domain of the spatial-temporal world of physical objects, events, processes, and forces. There's no supernatural. The Latin word supra means above. So supernatural is the belief that there is something above the natural universe. Not so, say the naturalists. Naturalists reject both the supernatural realm of existence and immaterial agencies and realities such as God, angels, and immaterial human souls. Anything that is not material, anything that is not physical, anything that is not reducible to or explainable in terms of matter and energy and space and time does not exist. The scientist Carl Sagan, a very famous astronomer from New York, expressed the position of strong naturalism in his famous statement for his television series Cosmos. Sagan said, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." So we can see that naturalism is a metaphysical system. It is purporting to tell us what the nature of reality is, and that reality is made up of the material physical universe only. Now, within this school of thought, this metaphysical or ontological approach, there is nevertheless debate among naturalists. Naturalists don't agree with each other. Yet while this definition, nature is the whole show, holds consistent among naturalists, a great deal of diversity nevertheless exists in their specific philosophical worldview. Michael Ray, who is a Christian professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, he's written extensively on naturalism. He says, quote, "The house of naturalism is a house divided. There is little agreement about what naturalism is or about what sort of ontology it requires." Now, the point there, I think, is very significant. While naturalists will say the physical universe is all there is, when it gets down to defining what that specifically is, there's lots of debate. As we'll see a little later, many naturalists do not want to be pegged with the definition of being materialists. But of course, my question is, how many options do they have? But I think they know that if they affirm materialism, they're in deep trouble, because materialism is self-defeating. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. Now, what I'd like to do this evening is to kind of introduce you to the basic beliefs of naturalism. I'm going to talk about what I call eight features of metaphysical naturalism or ontological naturalism. The word metaphysics just means the study of reality. Christianity is a metaphysical system. We have particular views about the nature of reality. That large word, ontology, just means the study of being. So naturalism is saying something about the nature of reality or the nature of being. And the eight points that I'm going to present to you, I like to think of them as the traits of naturalism, subcategories, if you will, to allow you to get a feel for what those beliefs really are that make up this broad system called naturalism. Now, the first one is monism. That's a Greek word. It means one or only. Monism, all reality is one thing or one stuff. Now, as Christians, we don't believe in monism. We believe there is the realm of the material world, but yet God created an immaterial, non-physical world. So we immediately embrace not monism, but dualism. Naturalism affirms that there is only one reality. Naturalism asserts that everything is composed of natural entities. Everything is reducible or explainable in terms of nature itself. Now, there are different types of naturalists. Some of them call themselves reductive naturalists. They say that all things are literally physical and material in nature. Others are non-reductive naturalists. They say that all things are physical, but they allow for emergent, intangible properties. Things like consciousness, intentionality, the ability to make choices and values. Obviously, we have a brain. I've had the great privilege of looking at my brain on a computer. I thought it would be bigger, frankly, when I saw that image. I thought there'd be thunder and lightning when I saw it. My boss, Hugh Ross, tells me, though, that size doesn't matter. It can be really bright, even if it's a little bit on the small side. Well, the idea here is you can see my brain. If you cut my skull open or you do a CAT scan or an MRI, you can see my brain, but you can't see my consciousness. You can't see my mind. You can't see myself, if you will, my ability to act as a person. And certainly you can't see values. We think we know what justice is, and when we observe people's behavior, we say that's just or that's unjust, but we don't actually see the value in and of itself. Naturalism is monistic because they agree that the physical universe with its constituents of matter, energy, time, and space is that one fundamental reality from which all things derived. So everything is explainable. Everything is reducible ultimately to matter in its constituent parts. Now, a second part of naturalism, a second trait, a second component of naturalism is oftentimes materialism. Materialism says that everything can be reduced to or explained in terms of matter or is ultimately dependent upon it. Now, naturalists insist that materialism is common among metaphysical naturalists, but naturalism does not necessarily entail materialism. Though I would again add, there are very few other ontological options. If you're not a materialist, if you reject the idea that matter is the ultimate reality, well, what else is there? I think many naturalists, however, do not like the tag materialism because they know that it's self-defeating. I mean, If I talk with a naturalist and I say, you don't believe in God? No, I don't believe in God. I would say, well, have you chosen not to believe in God because your logic and science has helped you derive that viewpoint? Or do you just have atheistic brain chemistry? If everything is material, it's difficult to get away from some type of determinism. But naturalists insist that while many naturalists are materialists, some are not. Since the God of the Bible is an immaterial, non-physical being, materialists dismiss God as non-existent and illusory. Anything that is immaterial, anything that is non-physical, is simply dismissed a priori. Materialists view matter either as eternal or as having emerged spontaneously from nothing. There is a scientific and philosophical maxim called, in Latin, ex nihil nihil fit. From nothing, nothing comes. The vast majority of research scientists in the world now have concluded that all matter, energy, time, and space had a singular beginning about 13.7 or 13.8 billion years ago. Now, how does the naturalist explain the emergence of matter, energy, time, and space if he asserts that it comes from nothing? A little bit later, we'll look at that question. From nothing, nothing comes. There was nothing on the outside, but we have this emergence of matter, energy, time, and space. Now, non-reductive materialists, they say that consciousness is a yet-to-be-understood matter and motion. Look, we just don't understand. We don't quite yet know how consciousness arises, how it works. We know that the brain and the mind are deeply connected, but we just don't know how it works. Others, reductive materialists, would say the physical brain causes the mind, analogous to how an engine causes exhaust or a fire causes smoke. One school of thought about mind and body is called epiphenomenalism. It says that there's a one-way causal relationship moving from matter, the brain, to the mind. And so an epiphenomenalist would say the brain causes the mind, but it's a one-way relationship. The brain causes the mind, but the mind has no effect upon the brain. When I was very ill a few years ago, I got to see my neurologist, and I thought, great, I get to talk to a neurologist. I'm gonna hit him with all my mind-body questions. And so I said to him, you know, I was looking at all his charts on the wall and everything, and he came in, and I said, you know, I have a question I'd like to ask you. I said, do you think that the brain causes the mind? Or do you think that the mind and the brain are distinct? And he looked at me and he said, well, I'm not quite sure I understand all of your philosophical questions. All I can tell you is I'm a Christian. I believe that when I die, I'll go into the presence of God. I thought, oh, man, I thought I was going to get to argue with somebody here about these ideas. He ended up being a Reformed Christian. So we agreed that there is more to us than merely the brain. Now, a third distinctive feature is called physicalism. Physicalism is materialism as applied to the mind-body problem. One of the big problems in philosophy is this mind-body problem. The difficulty of relating the seemingly immaterial, non-physical, and unobservable mind to the demonstrably material, observable brain and body. How do the two relate? How do we connect them and think about them? How do they influence each other? Physicalism asserts that all realities can be described and explained using only the vocabulary of chemistry and physics. So naturalism has a basic tendency to reduce things to a fundamental level, at this point, chemistry and physics. Physicalists assert that mental states, thoughts, sensations are identical to brain states, so that sensations and the like are nothing more than neurological conditions taking place in the human brain. Physicalists consider the brain to be the definitive cause of so-called mental events. Mental events are considered a property or function of the brain and thus a mere function of matter. Let me read that again. Mental events, my ideas, my sensations, my conscious life, if you will, are considered a property or function of the brain and thus a mere function of matter. When I go to the dentist, because I just can't get my mind around the idea of somebody putting a drill in my mouth. There's something unnatural about that. It's just unnerving that somebody would do that. So I have to kind of prepare myself for needles and drills and all of these kinds of things. So sometimes I'll say the Lord's Prayer in Latin. Sometimes that helps me to kind of focus and not think about the pain. But sometimes I will think to myself when they put that needle, you know, when they get the needle in your gum and the needle just barely pricks your gum. And see, I'm doing that on purpose. I'm trying to get you to feel those sensations. Well, I sometimes would ask myself, is the sensation of the needle pricking my gum? Is the sensation that I feel identical with the needle going in the gum? Or is the sensation, you know, that kind of, ugh, is that something other than the gum? Is that a self? Is that a person reacting to these kinds of issues? Well, the materialist, the physicalist would say, ultimately, everything is the function of matter. Physicalists outright reject mind-body dualism, sometimes called substance dualism. Mind-body dualism is the view that the mind and the body are distinct substances, but nevertheless influence each other in a two-way causal connection. Mind-body dualism or substance dualism is frequently the way Christian thinkers and philosophers seek to resolve this mind-body issue. You can go all the way back to Thomas Aquinas, who has a very powerful way of thinking about mind and body. In fact, I think Aquinas' understanding is much preferable to a later Catholic thinker named Descartes. Now, a fourth distinctive feature of naturalism is called scientism. Science is either the only reliable method, we might call this strong scientism, or the best method, a weak scientism, of obtaining genuine knowledge. Well, if the material universe is all there is, and if the only way we can really understand that world is through physics and chemistry, then science is the way to real knowledge. Some of them would say science is the only method of knowing. Others would say it's the best method of knowing. Here's a quotation from a website that seeks to defend naturalism. It says, "Naturalism as a worldview is based on the premise that knowledge about what exists and about how things work is best achieved through the sciences, not personal revelation or religious tradition." A fifth feature is Darwinian evolution. Have you ever asked the question, why do naturalists, why are they so staunch in their commitment to Darwinian evolution? Well, I would respond and say because it's the only game in town. If you're a naturalist, then the only option, really, of explaining the complexity of life that we discover in the world is through some form of evolution. And so people who are naturalists immediately gravitate to a simple, natural explanation. Naturalists assert that all life is the result of purely natural processes. Most evolutionists today, advanced biologists, for example, no longer believe really in a Darwinian mode. They don't believe in kind of a gradualism. Darwin thought that life began in a very primitive stage, and it was simply a gradual evolutionary method. Many people reject much of Darwin's thought. Even other evolutionists embrace the idea of punctuated equilibrium. That is, evolution takes place in spurts. It's very difficult to track. Stephen Jay Gould, the famous Harvard biologist, described evolution in a way, frankly, that many people would talk about creation. That life begins in a complex form. Go back to the Cambrian explosion about 640 million years ago. It's difficult to differentiate those ideas from creation. Naturalists staunchly defend some type of evolutionary theory because biological evolution is the only naturalistic explanation for life and the appearance of Homo sapiens. Where did they come from? How do we explain the complexity of life? Well, it had to have happened naturally. Evolution is a necessary explanatory component in the overall worldview of naturalism. Now, I should tell you that the question of the origin of life is a very difficult one. Some of the brightest people on planet Earth have spent the last 50 years trying to discover how that first life took place on planet Earth. And I don't think that I'm committing a straw man or exaggerating to say that the origin of life community has largely come up to a dead end. They really have no clear idea how life began on planet Earth. And I can tell you why they have essentially come to a dead end, because now they're suggesting that maybe life did not begin here on planet Earth. Maybe it began somewhere in space and it was transported to Earth. We call this panspermia. The idea that life began on some other planet in some other galaxy, somehow it traveled to planet Earth, and that's how life arose. There are quite a number of people in NASA who believe this. This is why you often hear them talking about, well, if there is water on Mars, maybe there is the source of life there. Well, remember that water is a necessary condition for life, but it's not sufficient. In one way, I guess we should say that this idea of looking to space to discover life is in some ways a concession that naturalists have not been able to find how life began on the Earth. And of course, from a Christian theistic viewpoint, we would say, you're not going to. You're going to discover that a naturalistic explanation is ultimately inadequate. Another feature of naturalism, and maybe right at the heart of naturalism, is just anti-supernaturalism. Naturalism, by its very definition, dismisses the supernatural a priori. Philosopher Peter Angelis explains naturalism's single-minded focus on the physical world. He says, quote, no reality exists other than the processes, events, objects, happenings, and occurrences in space and time. As one naturalist put it, quote, naturalism in essence is simply the idea that human beings are completely included in the natural world. There's nothing supernatural about us. Again, the Latin word supra means above the natural. The naturalist simply says the natural world is all there is. Now, most naturalists gravitate toward atheism, obviously. But there are some who are unsure, and they remain agnostics. An atheist is a person who says no gods are real, no gods exist. An agnostic, depending on whether he is dogmatic or a little more open, would say, I have no knowledge of God. Literally, these words, theism, the belief in a personal God, put an A in front of it, no God. Gnosis, one of the Greek words for knowledge, put an A in front of it, you negate it, no knowledge of God. So no God. God is illusory. He's an invention of the human mind. We say that God created man. The atheists say man created God. The agnostic just says there's no way of knowing, or at least I must suspend judgment on it because I simply don't know. Regardless, they're very skeptical of any kind of religious ideas. And the eighth point here is what I call secular humanism. Protagoras, the famous sophist who dialogued at the time of Socrates, Protagoras said that man is the measure of all things. In some ways, that corresponds to humanism. Secular humanism embraces all seven of the previous points of the family traits of naturalism. Secular humanism opposes belief in God, religion, and anything supernatural. Why are human beings the measure of all things? Because we have reached the highest tier of the evolutionary ladder. Therefore, we have value. We can think and reason in ways that other animals cannot. From the humanist perspective, morals and values, societal norms find their source, their foundation, and justification in the conventional agreement of humankind. Where do we come up with morality? Well, people get together and decide what's good and right, what mores one should embrace. The value system of humanism is characterized by four viewpoints. Libertarianism, which means to maximize individual liberty. Utilitarianism, promoting the greatest good for the greatest number. Relativism, a deep belief that morals and truth are subjective and changing in orientation. And then pragmatism. Something is good, something is right, something is true if it works, if it has positive consequences for human beings. And so this would reflect the kind of thinking of naturalists. Humanists typically view death as the extinction of human consciousness and the loss of individual and personal identity forever. I was reading one atheist article in the Free Inquiry, I think was the title of it, and he said, one of the things that really troubles me about being a naturalist and atheist is I've spent all of my life developing my mind, and then I'm going to lose it all. It's all going to end in death. Wow. Yeah. That's hard to grip. That's hard to embrace. When I was very sick and thought I was going to die, I wondered, how does a naturalist approach this kind of thing? How do they embrace the idea that death is the end of everything? Here are some of the historical humanist documents. You can read them. Humanist Manifesto 1 came out in 1933. The Manifesto 2 in 1973. Secular Humanist Declaration in 1981. And then just a couple years ago, the Humanist Manifesto 3. When I was a young college student studying philosophy, one thing that struck me right away, taking particularly social sciences and courses in the humanities, is I was struck by the fact that the vast majority of people who were the father of the fields of study that I was engaging in were largely natural. And I wondered, why aren't there more Christians in these fields? How come there aren't more Christian names? In science, some of the prominent naturalists, Darwin and Huxley, bringing us all the way to the common time, Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould, Richard Dawkins, who recently wrote a controversial book entitled The God Delusion. Social scientists, the father of modern psychology, the father of the analytic school of thinking, Sigmund Freud. Auguste Comte, the father of sociology. Then another philosopher who had quite an impact. When I told my father I wanted to study philosophy, he asked me, how much money does it pay? I said, Dad, I don't care about the money. I just want the truth. He said, you can't handle the truth. Well, philosophers do bake bread. That was the criticism of philosophy. It doesn't bake any bread. I have to admit, my dad was right. You don't get rich being a philosopher. But there are people who are philosophers who powerfully impact the world. Karl Marx being a prime example. Other philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche, the famous German thinker, who is not only a forerunner of existentialism, but also many of the ideas that we embrace in terms of postmodernism. Bertrand Russell, the famous philosopher, mathematician, social critic. A.J. Ayer, one of the early kind of scientific philosophers in the 20th century, developed a philosophy called positivism. The existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre. J.L. Mackey, the famous Oxford philosopher. By the way, if you want the best arguments for atheism, it's not Richard Dawkins, it's probably J.L. Mackey. His book, The Miracle of Theism, I think is the most intellectually rigorous examination of theistic ideas. I don't think he's successful, but he comes a lot closer than Richard Dawkins, who doesn't think that theology and religion and philosophy has much value at all. And then, of course, the famous philosopher of logic at Harvard University, Quine, saw himself as a naturalist. There are a number of distinguished naturalists as philosophers of mind, Paul and Patricia Churchland, and of course, John Searle. I'm told that John Searle is on the RTB mailing list. I would wonder what he would think of some of the things that we produce. Although I have to say, I think Searle has given some of the best critique of postmodern ideas, particularly Derrida's idea of deconstructionism. Okay, is there anything I can say tonight positive about naturalism? Yes. All worldviews have positive elements. Number one, the naturalist worldview probably scores high on one worldview test. In one sense, naturalism is simpler as an explanatory theory than is theism. As a naturalist, you don't posit another world besides this one. The naturalist simply says, I can explain everything in one world. Well, I don't think that passes Occam's razor ultimately, because Occam emphasized not just simplicity, but explanatory adequacy. But at least there is a simpleness about naturalism. Two, it does have some scientific import. It believes the material physical universe is really there, and natural things have some sense of explanation. It also stresses the importance of relevant, practical, and workable consequences. Naturalists usually emphasize science and technology. They believe that something's value should be measured in whether it works. So those are some positive features of naturalism. Now, let's look at the features that are not so positive. In fact, I hold the position, and it certainly did not begin with me. Many years ago, I read C.S. Lewis's book on miracles. And I came across this argument called the argument from reason. It has been popularized in the last few decades by the distinguished Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga, who's a professor at Notre Dame. Victor Reppert, who is a friend of mine who teaches philosophy at Glendale College in Arizona, wrote a recent book entitled C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. Richard Taylor, another distinguished philosopher, concurs that naturalism is incoherent. And if it's incoherent, it can't be true, and its Achilles heel rests on its inability to explain rationality. There was a recent edition of Philosophia Christi in which Reppert took on a couple different naturalists, and if you like philosophy, you'll love that edition. Well, let's raise the question here. Naturalism doesn't provide a reason to trust reason. I think that's correct. It fails the coherence test. The coherence test is a worldview has to be logically consistent. It has to avoid essential contradiction. It has to provide a basis for explaining human rationality. Now, this is a little difficult, but I want to have you to give it your best shot here, and I'm going to try to explain these ideas as clearly as I can. First of all, I think there's a coherence problem with naturalism because the mechanism that created your brain and my brain is not rational. And I'm arguing that naturalism, which leans heavily on Darwinian evolution, cannot explain rationality because the source that made you and me, the source that produced our rational faculties, was not itself rational. According to the worldview of naturalism, the source or foundation of man's reasoning was not itself rational. It wasn't endowed with reason. You're endowed with reason, and I am. But if we embrace naturalism, natural selection, the evolutionary mechanism, it wasn't rational. It wasn't endowed with reason. Nor was it personal. You and I are persons, but the mechanism that made us was not personal. It wasn't self-aware or intelligent. It wasn't teleological. According to naturalistic thinking about evolution, evolution didn't know that you and I were coming. It's based on random mutation. It's based upon natural selection. It's based on sex selection. This source that made you and me lacks those profound faculties that you and I possess. A combination of random chance and blind impersonal natural processes produced humanity's rational faculties. Now, as a matter of epistemological protocol, if not sound logical intuition, the non-rational should not be thought to produce the rational, nor the impersonal the personal, nor the ateleological the teleological. Take a look at the whiteboard here. I'm suggesting that naturalism, and again, in accord with Plantica and Lewis before him, frankly, the argument from reason probably goes back to Kant and maybe even before him to Plato and through Augustine. So the idea that I'm setting forth here is not new. But it is building steam, I think. Now, let's suppose, for sake of argument, that we're the product of evolution. We don't know exactly how life began, but you and I, our brains, our sensory organs, our cognitive faculties have been produced by evolution. Well, think a little bit about what I've written here. I'm using my rational faculties to draw the logical conclusion that the source of my reasoning wasn't rational. You know, most naturalists that I've ever spoken with, they tell me the reason why I'm a naturalist is because I'm a person of logic and reason and science. You, on the other hand, Ken, you're a person, you're an oddity. You like logic and philosophy, but you believe in this superstition called religion. So the naturalist says, I'm using my rational faculties, my brain and mind, to draw the logical conclusion that the source of my reasoning wasn't rational. I think that's self-defeating. They're essentially telling us, I'm using all of this high-powered rational faculties to draw the skeptical conclusion that what it was that produced my rational faculties doesn't have any of that stuff. I think that just as naturalists have attacked Christian theism on the problem of evil, and the problem of evil needs to be responded to, because if the problem of evil cannot be answered, it means that the Christian worldview is incoherent, and if it's incoherent, it can't be true. That's why over the last two millennia, the brightest Christians who have ever lived have responded to the problem of evil, because we see it as a threat to our faith. What I'm suggesting here is that we ought to attack, we should take out our knife and attack the worldview of naturalism by plunging our knife into the heart of naturalism and exposing their greatest weakness. They have no real explanation or justification for rationality. Now, let me put it in as simple terms as I can. The idea that whatever it was that produced me, the evolutionary mechanism, it produced me and it produced you, and you and I have consciousness, you and I can reason, we can think, we're persons, we have all of these wonderful, deep faculties. Well, here's the rub. The thing, the mechanism that made us lacks all of that. I can simply tell you, I just don't believe that. I just think that that's not rational. I think it's much more rational to conclude that the Christian theistic worldview that says there is a mind behind the universe that creates life is much more rational and scientific. Now, let's move ahead here. According to the presumptions of science, an effect requires an adequate and sufficient cause. But in the case of evolution, the effect of human intelligence is magnitudes or exponentially greater than its supposed cause. I mean, if evolution can't think or reason, if it's not a person, it's produced something that is incredible. Therefore, I say back to the naturalist, I don't think your worldview is rational. At the end of the day, I can't buy that. I believe that an effect has to have a sufficient cause. I think that the effect has to have a cause that has the faculties that are in the effect. I'm a father. I have three kids. the effect of my wife and I having these kids. These kids are the effect, but they have all the faculties, and I might tell you, probably even more than their parents. But not in terms of something beyond. An effect has to have a sufficient cause. I don't think evolution fits causality. Even if these non-rational factors did succeed in producing the rational faculties of human beings, how can it be known that the product of this basically non-intelligent process, the human brain and mind, can and should be trusted to deliver rational content? Why should I trust it if my brain came from chance? Why should I trust what my brain produces? Christian philosopher Paul Copan describes naturalism's epistemological crisis and self-defeating dilemma. He says, quote, "I'm relying on the very cognitive faculties whose unreliability is the conclusion of my skeptical argument. I'm assuming a trustworthy reasoning process to arrive at the conclusion that I can't trust my reasoning." I concur with Paul Copan. I think naturalism suffers from an incoherence. I think we have to posit something beyond the material in order to explain consciousness and mind. Naturalists are fond of asserting that they have embraced the worldview, their worldview, based upon purely rational factors, appealing to such things as logic and sound scientific understanding. But springing from the non-rational, they don't have a good reason to trust reason. Now, to be perfectly fair, not every Christian philosopher agrees with Lewis and Plantica and Repert and others, but many people do. And I don't think we have forced naturalists to give the kind of attention to their incoherence as they have forced us to deal with the problem of evil. Now, let's take it from another angle. And I apologize if this is kind of heady, but when you talk about the mind, it gets heady, right? Coherence problem B, survivability doesn't guarantee truth. I actually think this is the stronger argument right here. If evolution's sole activity is to promote a species' survivability, then how can people who have embraced evolutionary naturalism have confidence that their cognitive faculties provide reliable true beliefs? See, evolution was not about giving you true beliefs. Evolution is about the survivability of the species. Some naturalists have even suggested that the human beliefs in such things as God, immortality, and objective moral values was produced in man as a means of promoting human survivability. So even though these ideas are actually false, they somehow supported man's ability to survive and even thrive. But this theory would mean that false beliefs may at times do more to promote human flourishing than true beliefs. I don't want you to miss this. I want you to understand this. There are naturalists now who are telling you the reason why human beings have come to believe in God and believe in morality and believe in life after death, evolution caused those ideas to spring into our mind because believing in God and believing in moral values and life after death would help you survive physically. Now, wait a second here. If the evolutionary mechanism that created my mind put thoughts of God, life after death, and values, then it gave me false positives. Evolution has produced false ideas in my mind. Can I trust evolution if it produces false beliefs in my mind? If evolution can produce false beliefs in my mind, why should I trust my mind to believe that evolution is true? I think naturalism has a huge problem. I don't think it can explain reason and rationality. If naturalistic evolution can't guarantee truth, then the naturalist can't know that evolutionary theory is rationally superior to biblical creation, or that naturalism is logically preferable over Christian theism. See, I always talk with these naturalists, and they love logic, and they love science, and they're convinced that they're smarter than me. That's why they're atheists, and I'm a Christian. But I'm turning around and saying, but how can you think that evolution is superior to creation and naturalism is superior to theism when you have no basis for trusting your reason because it was chance that created that faculty? Naturalism as a worldview fails to provide a sufficient and meaningful basis for rationality. It is then self-defeating. Now, let me spend the rest of my time doing a little comparison with you. A good worldview, an adequate worldview, a sufficient worldview, a viable worldview, has to have real explanatory power and scope. The power is its ability to explain, and the scope is how much it can explain. Well, let's just do a little comparison, the naturalist worldview on one side, the Christian worldview on the other. I want you to ask yourself, which seems more reasonable? Which has greater explanatory power? Which worldview can explain more? Origin of the universe, the physical universe, according to the naturalist, emerged from nothing. By no one, and without a specific plan or purpose. Wow. Emerged from nothing, by no one, with no plan or purpose. I've heard naturalists say this in debate. One naturalist debated William Lane Craig and said, we're left with the belief that the world came from nothing by no one and without a plan or a purpose. Wow. Faith? Trust? Christian view, origin of the universe? The universe was created ex nihilo, out of nothing, by an infinite, eternal, and tripersonal God for his own glory. It's amazing to me that the doctrine of creation ex nihilo seems incredibly consistent with the cutting-edge views of cosmology today, that matter, energy, time, and space had a beginning. The Apostle Paul, on a number of occasions, said that God created what we would today call physical time. You're not going to find that in any other ancient religious books. How about design in the universe? The naturalist says order, regularity, and fine-tuning in the universe emerge coincidentally, possibly from other worlds. I'll talk about that later if somebody wants to ask about it. Christian view, order, regularity, and fine-tuning in the universe came from God's creative plan and purpose. Which one has greater causal explanation? How about the first life? Naturalism, life somehow emerged accidentally from non-living matter through purely natural processes. Christian view, God, who possesses life in himself as an eternal and everlasting being, created the various life forms. Which has greater explanatory power? Which cause is able to more sufficiently explain the effect? How about personhood? Naturalist persons emerge from impersonal and unintelligent natural processes or force. If I'm a naturalist, I have to conclude that at some point on planet Earth, there were no persons. What produced the person? A non-personal mechanism. So personhood came from non-personhood, as opposed to the Christian worldview that says as a super-personal triune God, our God is not personal. He's super-personal. He's more than personal. God made human beings personal and intelligent creatures. How about minds? Where did our minds come from? The naturalists say mindless and or non-conscious natural processes produce beings with minds that are self-conscious. Wow. The Christian worldview says that God's infinite and eternal self-conscious mind is the cause of the finite self-conscious minds of his creatures. Rationality. Naturalism says human rational faculties and sensory organs came from a blind, non-rational survival mechanism. Christian worldview says that human rational faculties and sensory organs were created in the image of an all-wise God. How about morality? I think morality is every bit as real as gravity. I don't think you can be a good person and deny that there are moral principles built into the universe in which we live. Where did those moral principles come from? How do we ground them? What is their justification? The naturalist worldview says that blind, impersonal, and non-moral natural forces stand behind purely human moral conventions. Christian worldview says God is a perfect moral being, and his holy character is the source and foundation of all moral goodness. How about epistemological content, knowledge, information, truth? Where does that come from? You know, you look at the DNA code, it's loaded with information. You look at the cell functions at a higher level than the best design motors and engines that humans can create. Nature does it better. How do we explain that? How do we explain the information? The naturalist, information, knowledge, and truth came from a blind, impersonal, an unintelligent natural source. Christian worldview, information, knowledge, and truth came from an infinitely wise and rational God who is truth himself. Aesthetics. Beauty. Beauty and elegant theories, according to the naturalist, came from blind, purposeless, and valueless natural processes. Beauty and elegant theories, according to Christian theism, came directly from God's creative power and infinitely wise mind. Oops. Human value. Do we have any value? Humans are the product of valueless, purposeless, and accidental natural processes and forces, as opposed to the Christian worldview that says humans have inherent dignity and moral worth and absolute rights because they bear God's image. It's wrong to murder an unborn life because that life is made in the image of God. It's two things you can do in your life that will change your being. It'll change your ontology. One of them is having sex with another person. That changes you. So if you're a young person and you're thinking about sexuality, remember that a philosopher told you having sex changes your being. You become one with that other person. Another way you can change your being is to take the life of a being that's made in the image of God. That's why my dad, who was a distinguished war veteran, came home after World War II after killing, I don't know, dozens of German soldiers. And my dad wrestled the rest of his life with this issue of killing those men. Even though my dad was on the right side. Humans have dignity, according to the Christian worldview, because they're made in the image of God. And if you attack the image of God, you're attacking God. That doesn't mean there isn't a time to kill, but it means that killing is never easy. The costs are high. Human volition, our ability to make choices. People emerged, according to naturalists, from mechanistic natural forces beyond their personal volitional control. The Christian worldview says people were created with free agency by a God who has supreme freedom of choice and action. He gave us free agency. Human meaning, while there's no meaning, say the naturalists, while there's no ultimate meaning to human life, there may be subjective meaning in life by choice. I had a student in one of my classes, she was a very bright girl, young woman. She said to me in one of her essays, she said, I don't think life has any meaning. So I wrote back to her and said, that's a very meaningful conclusion you've come to. When I first read C.S. Lewis's little book, Mere Christianity, Lewis talks about fish at the bottom of the ocean who've never emerged up. He says, do fish who live their entire life at the bottom of the ocean, do they know they're wet? If we were meaningless, how would we ever come to the meaningful conclusion that we're meaningless? I remember reading that for the first time. So all my friends, I'd stop them, do fish at the bottom of the ocean know they're wet? You know? And they were like, go away, please. I thought it was like, wow, what an insight. Unmet human needs. This is my concluding remarks. I think that naturalism fails to meet the deepest existential needs of human beings. A worldview needs to give people purpose and significance. You know, in some parts of our country, the suicide rate is higher than the murder rate. I've always been interested in people who become wealthy and famous almost overnight. You know, you look at some of the musicians, the entertainers, the sports athletes. I remember reading a biography of John Lennon. There's this group in the 60s called the Beatles. Kind of popular. John Lennon said in 1965 at the height of Beatlemania, he said, "I have more money than my grandkids can spend." I don't know, Yoko might be able to spend it, we'll see. He said, "I've slept with women from all around the world." All of these groupies. He said, "Everybody virtually on the planet knows my name." And he said, "I'm completely unhappy." So when you hear that song, "Help," Lennon actually meant it. I've achieved everything I've ever wanted, and he asked, "Is this all there is?" You ever study the life of Elvis Presley? How about Michael Jackson? It's very difficult, I think, on people who have everything. I'm sure you and I have been tempted at times to think, what would it be like to have everything? So much money, video games galore, Michael. You know, everything you want, pleasure at your fingertips, and then you come to the conclusion that Pascal came to. Rich people know what poor people don't. And that is that money really doesn't make you happy. Is that all there is? Is there nothing more? Naturalism fails to make moral sense of the universe. No objective basis for prescriptive morality. Naturalism has no basis for affirming that people have authentic inherent dignity and moral worth. They are, in a sense, valueless animals. You know, you can live like Hitler or you can live like Mother Teresa. But as J.P. Moreland says, it's really the choice between McDonald's and Burger King. Or if you have greater class, Wendy's and Carl's Jr. It's simply an irrelevant choice. Naturalism fails to provide humans with meaning, purpose, and significance. As Kierkegaard said, a reason to live and a reason to die. I want a reason to live and a reason to die. I want a philosophy of life. I want a faith that gives me reason to live to the fullest, and when I get ready to die, it also gives me purpose and significance. Now, this is my last point. According to naturalism, the ultimate fate of the individual, humanity, and even the universe will inevitably be the same regardless of what any person may do. You're going to die. I'm going to die. We're all going to die. According to most of the naturalist physicists, humanity probably has a window of life, and it's not terribly long. We are going to live a few thousand years. The dinosaurs have lived a lot longer than we'll ever live. So I'm going to die. You're going to die. We're going to die collectively because all people die. The death rate is one per person, as Walter Martin used to say. But not only are you going to die and I'm going to die, but according to the physicists, the universe is going to die. At maximum entropy. We're going to use up all of the energy in the universe, and this incredible universe is just going to grow cold. Now, according to naturalism, nothing that anyone thinks, says, or does will change the fact that each individual person, all of humanity collectively, and the universe itself due to entropy, will someday be utterly extinct, lifeless, and cold. The outcome of naturalism is an inevitable hopelessness. That's my view. I think your worldview gives you what naturalism can. Your worldview as a Christian gives you a reason to live and a reason to die. Your worldview says that God will someday send his Son, will bring human history to a close, and we will live in a new heaven, in a new earth. We will survive the death of our body. And the gospel gives us meaning and purpose and significance. Okay, well, that's the lecture portion. We like to let people ask questions or make comments, but you have to go to the microphone because we want to record your question. So who would like to maybe begin this evening?
confused with the ex nihilo.
Okay, just got to talk right into the microphone. Pull it down. Get close to the microphone.
I'm confused with the ex nihilo bit is.
Okay. This is the expression I've written on the board, ex nihil nihil fit. Nihil is Latin for nothing. So ex means out of nothing, nothing comes. So you can't get something for nothing is the idea. It's a scientific idea, it's a philosophical idea, that you can't get something from nothing. Now, the Christian worldview, however, says that God has the incredible ability to reach into non-existence and create existence. So, before creation, Michael, only God existed. There was no matter, no energy, no space, no time. Only God existed, but He existed as three persons, so He didn't need to create us because He had a loving community. But God, by the use of His power and His wisdom, took non-existence and created existence. And I have to tell you, that's exactly what people say at MIT and Caltech. I know that some Christians are a bit troubled by the idea of Big Bang because they think, wow, you're talking billions of years and the ideas. I can only tell you, however, that I think Big Bang cosmology, which doesn't say anything metaphysical. The Big Bang doesn't tell you who or what or why. It just tells you that. Well, creation ex nihilo says that matter, energy, time, and space had a singular beginning. And so the naturalist, Michael, is saying out of nothing, nothing comes. Well, how do we get something from nothing? In the Christian worldview, we get something from someone. So that's the Latin phrase.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to know, what's the difference between naturalism and logical positivism? It seems like they're similar in some way.
Okay. Let me in fact, write that here on the whiteboard. Logical positivism. Logical positivism is a type of naturalism. Logical positivism is a philosophy that emerged in the early part of the 20th century. Essentially, it was some scientific and philosophical thinkers who got together and said, you know, philosophy never really gives any good answers to anything. We want a philosophy that's based on science. And so they developed an approach that says, look, unless something can be verified, it just has no meaning and purpose. So you can verify it by observation. You can verify it through falsification. So logical positivism said, that we only are going to believe in things that can be verified. The problem, however, is logical positivism cannot be verified that way. So a lot of these types of thinkers have largely given up on logical positivism. I'm not sure any logical positivists exist anymore. I will tell you an interesting story, however. One of the major players in the logical positivist movement was a man named A.J. Ayer. A.J. Ayer, Language, Truth, and Logic is one of the books that he wrote. He was one of the most distinguished atheists of his time, British. Ayer had a near-death experience. He had a brush with death and recovered, thus near death rather than permanent death. And when he came back, he wrote some essays to his students explaining that I consciously existed after my body was dead. I can't tell you what that did to all the people who loved A.J. Ayer's atheism. They were like, what? Ayer said that he encountered a reality, and the reality was not happy with him. And the reality was judging him. And he said later, I don't know if what I encountered was God, but I do know that you live beyond the death of your body. Now, what would that be comparing to? That would be like Richard Dawkins having a near-death experience. Logical positivism is kind of a primitive form of naturalism, very physicalistic in its orientation. Largely, it has gone the way of the dinosaur, however. No longer a philosophical option. Okay, anybody else? Your opportunity. Go right to the mic.
Howdy, Professor.
Hi.
I have a question. Is the argument that rationalism cannot come from irrationalism an argument? Does it still stand valid when a person believes that the rationalism that they experience in their head is simply a state of mind? I guess what I'm trying to say is, if our mind has been created through a series of evolutional steps, could not rationalism also have been created in the same series of steps?
Okay, it's a good question. And by the way, this argument, it's slippery. This is not an argument that is kind of easy to get your mind all around. It's kind of like the ontological argument for the existence of God. There are days I think it's absolutely the greatest argument, and then another day I'm thinking, oh. I think it takes a lot of reflection to see what this argument is saying. And additionally, I don't think it's one argument. Victor Reppert, in his book, C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea, presents it in a variety of ways. So it's not just one argument. Let me tell you a story, and then I'll try to respond specifically. Richard Taylor, who is a philosopher, he's religious, not necessarily Christian. Taylor, in one of his books on metaphysics, Prentice Hall, I think, is the publisher, Taylor said that, he tells this story. He said, imagine being on a train, and he talks about going to London. I'm going to talk about going to San Diego. Suppose everybody in this room jumps on an Amtrak train, and we go down to San Diego to visit the zoo. Maybe we'll stop off at Westminster Seminary while we're down there. Suppose on our way down, we look up at the hillside, and on the hillside, spelled out in these nice, round, shiny white rocks, it says, welcome to San Diego, and it has an arrow, and it says, 10 minutes from the zoo. We think, all right, you know, we're almost there. And then the conductor comes along and says, oh, I'm sorry, that's not a sign on the hill. We had some seismic activity in the area. There's been a lot of erosion. And the rocks emerged out of the earth purely by natural processes. And they were placed in that pattern that spells out San Diego, you know, 10 minutes, but it's not really a message. Now, how many of you would believe the conductor when they said that? That's kind of a leap. Kind of a leap, right? But here's where Taylor really comes across. How many of you, if you believed that the rocks on the hillside had happened purely by chance, how many of you would still believe you're 10 minutes from San Diego? Taylor's point is, we don't trust non-rational, impersonal sources to give us communicative information. Now, Taylor says this, your brain evolved just like those rocks on the hill. Your brain is just as much an accident as those rocks on the hill. If you don't trust nature to tell you information by purely natural processes, then why do you trust your brain, which came from evolution? I can only tell you, I find that convincing. I can find it convincing. How is it? And so back to the issue. Could evolution kind of produce a state of consciousness? Well, let's say it could. Let's grant the naturalist presupposition that somehow naturalism has produced human consciousness. The question still remains to be answered. Can you trust what you get out of that brain that came by chance? And let's then take a minimalist argument. See, I'm going after the heart of naturalism. I'm taking out the knife, and I'm going for the heart. But let's not do that. Let's be more gentlemanly about it. Let's then just ask the question, based on all that data, origin of life, origin of the universe, person, all these things, which worldview are those ideas more at home in? The naturalist worldview or the Christian theistic worldview? If God exists and God created human beings and God has the attributes the Bible gives them, I think we could expect that he would do just what he did. So maybe you don't want to go after naturalism with the blade. Maybe you just want to say, which worldview do these things fit more in? Albert Einstein said, look, there is a rational world order. You can understand the universe through the use of mathematics. What? An evolved brain produced ideas, and those ideas correspond to reality? That makes a lot of sense in the Christian worldview. Why? God made you in his image. He gave you the ability to understand, to reason, and to think. But from a naturalist point of view, with all due respect, and there are men who are naturalists who are a lot brighter than I am. I just think they don't have a rational worldview. Greg Bahnsen used to say, naturalists think pretty well. Sometimes they think better than Christians, but while they can think and they can count, they cannot account for counting. I think what you are listening to here in some ways is similar to this transcendental argument that Van Til made popular. How do you explain the non-physical concepts of life? Richard Taylor is a good source for these ideas, as is Victor Reppert, as is a lot of the articles that are now on the internet by Alvin Plantinga. I think it's a powerful philosophical argument. Okay, anybody else? Your opportunity. Sir, John.
Okay, just a brief comment on logical positivism, and then you can comment on that if you wish.
Sure.
And then if you want me to ask a question.
Yeah, sure.
I had mentioned to you.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if it's appropriate even to do that. It seems to me logical positivism is not favorable because it basically says it's meaningless to talk about non-empirical realities such as love, such as justice, such as truth. And naturalists, many, even though they deny a transcendent reality beyond empirical reality, they still want to talk about those things. And there's still some hope that those things may have some kind of solution, or they can find it in some way. So it becomes unpopular to press. It's really pressing a naturalistic worldview to its extreme position, logical positivism. And
yeah, I completely concur. I would even say, John, that I think that logical positivism is largely an unlivable position. Human beings really can't live without values, without truth, without the things. I would even say maybe many of the most meaningful things in life you can't see. And the naturalist really doesn't have a good explanation for the things you can't see, is what I would say.
Roman Catholic worldview versus a Reformed Christian worldview versus a mainstream evangelical worldview, such as would generally be held by all of them. And then to comment on what's his name? I forgot his name now.
Frank Beckwith.
Yeah, Beckwith's decision to rejoin the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah. John, I don't think that I would describe Catholicism and Protestantism and then even forms of Protestantism as having, I don't know that the differences that Protestants and Catholics have or varieties of Protestants are necessarily worldview differences. I mean, as much as Roman Catholics and Protestants disagree about biblical authority, about justification by faith, about the nature of the sacraments, I don't think that those are necessarily worldview differences. Largely, we look at life through a very similar prism. We believe that God is transcendent, infinite, eternal, tripersonal. We believe that Christ became the incarnate Son of God. Our views of knowledge, I think, are similar. Our value systems are similar. Surely, I have more in common with conservative Catholics than I do with liberal Protestants. So I don't know that the differences of the Reformation are worldview differences. I would say I think we orient our worldview differently. That is, there are certain things in that worldview that are emphasized in Catholicism that are different than the way we emphasize them in Protestantism. So a Catholic and a Protestant would embrace a theistic worldview, a Christian worldview. Now, again, some people are not willing to call Catholics Christian. But if they believe in the Nicene Creed, it demonstrates, I think, how much in common they have with us, even if they're wrong about quite a number of important issues. Frank Beckwith. How many of you have heard Frank Beckwith or read anything by Frank Beckwith? Frank Beckwith is a brilliant Christian thinker. I've known Frank since the time I worked at the Christian Research Institute, which goes back to the late 1980s. Walter Martin used to have Frank do some research on Baha'ism, and that's when I met Frank. Frank took a PhD in philosophy, and so we always like to talk about ideas. Frank grew up a Roman Catholic. I think he was confirmed in the church about 13 years old. And then as an older teenager, he became an evangelical Christian. I think he, through his study of the Bible or some things, he became an evangelical. And then just about 2 weeks ago, he, by the way, is a distinguished philosopher, was the president of the Evangelical Theological Society, and a couple weeks ago he returned to the Roman Catholic Church. And it caused quite a controversy and lots of discussion. I guess you're asking me, what do I think about this, and maybe how do I work through it, is essentially what you're asking. I think the way I would put it, John, is I think it probably is structured differently. But obviously the differences between Catholics and Protestants are not as monumental as our differences with pantheism, with atheism, and things of that nature. I think we probably orient the worldview differently, but Catholics and Protestants are both deeply theistic in their orientation. My thoughts about Frank Beckwith. I like Frank. I respect Frank. He had a right to make the decision that he did. Why are people attracted to Catholicism? Well, I think there are attractive features of Catholicism. As a philosopher, Roman Catholic philosophers, I think, have basically been have had greater accomplishments than Protestant thinkers. Catholicism is very at home with philosophy. In Protestantism, we're sometimes not very comfortable with people who are philosophically inclined. I've had people tell me, you're too philosophical. Catholicism has more of an open door toward philosophy. Another thing that I think is attractive about Catholicism to many people is that it emphasizes its historical connectedness, that they attempt, I don't think they're as successful maybe as Dr. Beckwith thinks they are, but they attempt to connect themselves in history. I mean, a lot of evangelicals think that Christianity began with Chuck Smith at Calvary Chapel. And then I say, well, have you ever read Augustine? Have you ever read Tertullian? You know, there have been quite a few thinkers around. I think another feature is that maybe Dr. Beckwith had a really bad time with Baylor. Maybe evangelicalism left a really bad taste in his mouth. And so maybe there were a variety of reasons why Frank made the decision. It'll be interesting, I think, to hear a careful thinker like him describe the journey that he went on. But I have to tell you, when Protestants come up to me and say, oh, I can't think of anything good about Catholicism, I can. I think Catholicism has some strengths. At the end of the day, I'm a Reformation Protestant. But, you know, it is a church that has an intellectual tradition that I sometimes think is a bit rare in evangelicalism. You know, the Reformed tradition is very cerebral, and I appreciate that. You know, it is the Reformed tradition that's produced the Plantikas, and I think there's a reason for that. But I could see why particularly a philosopher would have some attraction to the Roman Catholic Church. You know, I used to be a Roman Catholic, and I have to say, though, to my friend Professor Beckwith, that in my view, it's a risky thing to put your confidence in a religious system that, in my view, is really confusing about the gospel. What I really love about the Reformed tradition, what I love about the Reformation gospel, which in my view is nothing but the biblical gospel, it is knowing that I am saved by grace, through faith, in Christ, period. I don't need Mary, as much as I respect her and think that Protestants probably ought to talk more about the role that Mary is every bit as important maybe as some of the apostles in terms of her response to Christ. But Catholicism, I think, has a very confusing gospel. You never know if you've done enough. You never know if you've prayed enough. You never know if you've reached a level of morality that is enough. That, to me, is not a system that I could easily embrace, as much as I love and respect Thomas Aquinas, Anselm, and many others, would be my point. Okay, let's bring it to a close. How about a brief prayer? And then there's some coffee back there. There's some books that you can enjoy. The purpose of the Academy is to allow people to come and talk about ideas and to engage these ideas. So let's go ahead and pray and we can close. Father, thank you for the opportunity to think about ideas. Thank you, Lord, for creating us in your image. We owe you, God, so much. There's no way that we can repay you for what you, through your Son and by your Spirit, have done for us. We only exist because you have created us and providentially keep us in existence. Our mind can only operate, Lord, because it is connected and created by you. And all of our sins, our salvation, is perfectly accomplished through your Son. Lord, we owe everything to you. There's nothing that we could do to ever pay you back. But we desire to live lives that are pleasing to you merely out of gratitude because you first loved us. In the name of Christ our Lord, we pray.